Author and social critic James Howard Kunstler joins us this morning to discuss his new novel, Look, I'm Gone. The book is a coming-of-age tale set in November of 1963 that captures a moment in America where we lost our innocence. James Howard Kunstler is the author of 19 books, including The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, Too Much Magic, and the four-volume novel series World Made by Hand. He was an editor at Rolling Stone magazine in the 1970s, and his journalism has appeared in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic Monthly, among others. He'll be speaking about the book at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs on Thursday, January 15th at 6 p.m. Set against the crackle of AM radios, Times Square dives, Park Avenue penthouses, and the uneasy hush that followed November 22nd, 1963, the day of the assassination of President Kennedy, Look, I'm Gone blends historical fiction, social satire, and teenage rebellion into a journey from the gothic rituals of prep school to the vibrant yet perilous streets of mid-1960s Manhattan. I began our chat by asking James Howard Kunstler why he was interested in beginning a book during November 1963.
I've been thinking about it a lot. And, you know, I had an experience when I was a child. Back in the early 60s, my stepfather was the PR guy for the League of New York Theater Owners. And we used to get a lot of tickets to things and invitations to parties. And we got an invitation to a party on stage at the Sound of Music. And I developed a crush on the girl who played the middle child, who was about 12 years old, and I was about 12 years old. And that kind of, the feeling of that incident stayed with me for 60 years.
Really?
And, or more. And it became kind of the centerpiece of this novel, which is about a boy sent home from a prep school. He's been sent to a prep school that's, you know, for bad boys because he's misbehaved. I've written a lot about this kid. I published six previous novellas about this kid. And he's been sent home to New York the weekend of that followed the Kennedy assassination. It happened on a Friday. And with all the other boys at school. And he goes back to his home in Manhattan. And, you know, after the three-day ordeal of following the funeral and all of that stuff on TV, he goes out and he's at large in New York City. It also happens that on the night before the JFK assassination, he won quite a bit of money in a poker game.
There you go.
In the carriage, in the old carriage house at the prep school. And so he has, shall we say, funding for his adventures. And that sort of kicks off the novel.
So this is a very talk showy question, but is how close is Jeff Greenaway to you?
Jeff, the protagonist of Look, I'm Gone. Well, you know, it's impossible to say that that large parts of him are not, you know, do not derive from me and my personality. But you know, when you're writing fiction, characters take on a life of their own,
yeah.
And he very much does take on a life of his own. He's taking on another life. You know, he's it is that time in history when every pubescent and adolescent kid in America is reading The Catcher in the Rye. And he becomes obsessed with, as many people, kids do, he becomes obsessed with the hero of that book,
Holden Caulfield.
Yeah. You know, kids who are growing up, when boys are growing up, and girls too, I suppose, you know, you're struggling to find some persona to hang your personality on. And Holden Caulfield was an irresistible target for so many kids because he kind of defined a defiant, somewhat profane and humorous, comical personality that, you know, a kid just wanted to adopt.
Now, when I first read that book, it would have been 20 years later than the time frame you're talking about, but it struck me the exact same way.
Sure. And plus, you know, young Jeff in 1963 is reading about Holden Caulfield, who is really depicted by J.D. Salinger as, you know, in the milieu of the 1930s when Salinger himself was an adolescent. He never really does mention the Second World War or anything else surrounding the events of the book, but, you know, you can figure it out.
What do you enjoy about writing about Jeff and sort of seeing where he goes and where he lands and what happens to this young man?
Well, he surprises me most of the time. I like to let characters act out on their own. And, you know, the center of the book, of course, was the set piece where, for one reason or another, he goes to a matinee on Broadway of a musical that is like The Sound of Music, but not really the same.
Right.
I think I called it The Wayward Family Singers. And he decides to go backstage and meet the middle child in the cast of the play. And he ends up going out on a date with her. And, you know, it's kind of one of those enchanted events of growing up, you know, the first time that you actually, you know, you're surrounded, you're at a school and you're surrounded by young men, adolescents who are constantly talking about girls. And you don't know much about it at your age. You know, you're in the first class at the school. And but here, all of a sudden, you have this opportunity to go out with a glamorous Broadway ingenue, which is what Kathy Kane is. She's also a somewhat troubled child. She's one of these professional children from the Midwest who come to New York to be on Broadway, who end up living in a hotel under rather poor supervision at an early age. And she's learned a lot of the angles. So,
and like a show business life, and yet, you know, you still haven't gone through puberty yet.
Yeah. Well, she has actually.
Yeah. Okay.
She's a year older than him, and she's an older woman, and she kind of, you know, she kind of leads him down the garden path. You know, they have an interesting romance. There's nothing really sexual about it, or explicit, but you know, they're young kids who are learning about being with the opposite sex, but it ends rather badly, and he goes on to have further adventures in the book, including he's been hanging out on Park Avenue and 68th Street where the old Soviet mission to the UN used to be, in a beautiful neoclassical building, and he's out there harassing the KGB goons who guard the door, and eventually they have to deal with him. Because he keeps on coming back and doing it repeatedly. He's been told at school by a kid who has the nickname Einstein, because he does everybody's math homework for money, that the Russians are behind the JFK assassination. And, of course, like just about everybody, young, middle, and old in the American population in November of 1963, he's greatly disturbed by the Kennedy assassination. It's hard to overstate how distressing that was to everybody in America. And that sort of underlies the tension in the book.
There is a lovely, I want to talk about that tension, but there is, and this is going back to what you were talking about before, but there's nostalgia. There's a sweetness to this.
Yeah. Well, there's something sweet about childhood, just to begin with, and especially, you know, a kid who's kind of bumbling around trying to navigate through it. He's, you know, there are certain things that incidents that really stand out, like when he's gone to Abercrombie and Fitch, the old sporting goods outfit on 45th Street and Madison Avenue, and he's bought the kind of red hunting hat that Holden Caulfield is wearing in The Catcher in the Rye, and he's wearing it in Grand Central Station at a certain point, and a policeman accosts him. And, you know, he asks him why he's wearing his hat backwards, and can't you turn your hat around? And Jeff says, you know, he's trying to practice being an adult. And that's really what's going on through the whole novel. He's trying to practice being an adult. Uh, he he has some notions about how you go about it, and he's testing them.
What is it, do you think, about the Kennedy assassination specifically that changed this young man?
I think the same thing that changed the country. Just the fact that it was such a shocking break from the normality of the post-war period when things, he had just come back from this war against manifest evil in Europe and the Pacific. And things had settled down and, we were living in that hyper-normality of Davy Crockett on TV and Walt Disney and Chevrolets and Ike in the White House. And you probably didn't live through it because you're a bit younger than I am, but I did live through the 1950s. And it's also hard to overstate the sense of normality and also how it's associated with the comforts and security of childhood, where you're really protected by your parents from the evils of the world, so I think that's the break from that was really disturbing for everybody, and also just the fact that Kennedy he was such a young man, and he represented the energy of his generation, which was really coming into power with him, at age 43. I guess he was 46 when they shot him, but he was still very young.
When Jeff is reading A Catcher in the Rye, and he's going through this time, he feels it's a book written for him specifically almost, and really embodying it. And yet, what is it about that persona, if you will, of the sort of brings him into those days after the assassination that propels him forward?
Well, I guess it's the fact that Holden Caulfield feels very displaced in his own milieu of the Manhattan of the 1930s or early 40s. And Jeff feels very displaced by the events of his time. He has, after all, been sent away from home to a school for troubled boys. And you do meet his parents. His parents are in the book. They come in and out of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty much left him to his own devices. He's not really given much guidance about anything. They're not bad people, but they're very wrapped up in their own lives in Manhattan in that day. And he's at loose ends.
I remember when I was first introduced to Catcher in the Rye, here is a book that is that has a character who is young, depressed, perhaps, and then, as the book goes on, the end ends basically in the same place. Your character does not. Your character does seem to get out of that funk, as it were. And I wonder is how much of that was just reality or wishful thinking.
Oh no, it's the reality of the novel.
Yes.
Sure. And of course, I don't want to create too much of a spoiler here, but, my character, Jeff, develops this obsession with going to meet J.D. Salinger.
Yeah.
And in fact, in The Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger's character, speaking through Holden Caulfield, says, when you read a book that really affects you, you want to meet the author and talk to him and have a conversation. And that's exactly how Jeff feels. So, after his misadventures in New York that have, caused him even more distress, he decides to just run away from New York and go back to New Hampshire. And it happens that J.D. Salinger lives not far from his prep school in New Hampshire. And he manages to get to find J.D. Salinger's home. And on a blizzardy evening, when Salinger's wife and kids are away in New York, Jeff Greenaway comes into the house of J.D. Salinger, and we meet him as a fictionalized character. I like to think it's the first time that J.D. has really appeared, you know, on stage in a work of American literature. I was informed that he's actually kind of brought on stage in one of Kinsella's novels. I think it's the baseball novel, but not by name.
Yeah,
but here there's no question who we're seeing, and of course J.D. Salinger has been gone. He passed away about 15 years ago, so you know he's a historical character now, and you know he's you can write about him as much as you can write about Henry VIII or Abraham Lincoln.
Obviously, a known recluse and not somebody who wanted the spotlight, but. In your characterization, this is somebody who obviously has things to say about the world.
Oh yeah, well he has a major role in the novel. He's not just a walk-on character, and you know he's stuck in his home in a blizzard with this 12-year-old boy, who's kind of a cheeky young guy, and I read a great deal about J.D. Salinger to prepare for this. You know there are quite a few books about him, including. The book by his 18-year-old girlfriend, yeah. Joyce Maynard, who he kind of inveigled into his life when he was in his 50s. And she was a Yale freshman or sophomore who wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine about what it was like to be a young hippie girl in 1971. And Salinger wrote her a fan letter and eventually developed this relationship with her. Through his whole life, he had kind of sketchy relationships with adolescent girls. So she wrote a memoir about that, and there's a great deal that you learn about his personal behavior around his house and even what his house looked like. And you could set the scene and set him into motion. There was also the book by his daughter Peggy, Margaret Salinger, who had kind of a rough childhood with him. And there was Shane Salerno's biography, which is very informative. So, there's a lot to learn about him out there now that he's gone. And the one sense that you got about him from reading all this stuff is that, and also from the fact that his estate has not published anything in 15 right. years, is you really wonder whether he ever wrote anything after 1967 or 68, you know?
Yeah. It's like one of those, like Harper Lee, and they come up with these with the books that they say she authorized, but that was still under question. But she had made it very clear she didn't want to publish anything. And obviously, had he wanted to publish anything, he could have done whatever he wanted to.
Well, he certainly could have. I mean, anybody would have published him. Yeah. The last thing that Salinger published was a short story about one of the Glass children called Hapworth, 1924 or something like that, about a kid at a summer camp writing a letter home to his siblings. And it says it's full of esotericism and things that a kid really wouldn't know anything about. But, you know, it was a very strange story. And it's the last thing he ever published. It was in The New Yorker. And that was it. After that, he just sort of stopped and clammed up. And maybe he was pretending to write or who knows. And, you know, he did have a family life up to a point. You know, he had two children with his wife, Claire. They did get divorced, I think, in the late 60s, but he built a house nearby, I think, on the same road or very, very close. And, you know, they raised their children that way. But, you know, he was a strange guy. And, you know, you find out exactly how strange he was in my book. And, you know, at the very end, Jeff is kind of done with him.
When you look at somebody like that, obviously Salinger is a writer, you're a writer. I mean, do you think of, do you look at it and say, I don't know, I can't put myself in the place of somebody who wouldn't want to write, who wouldn't want to communicate to the world what they're thinking. I mean, we started off this conversation by talking about, you know, you're doing as many books as you were before,
yeah.
in the early
Well, he was clearly a very damaged, Salinger was clearly very damaged, and probably by World War II. You know, his upbringing wasn't that tough. He was basically a Park Avenue kid from a wealthy family, or, you know, very well-off upper middle class family. But the war really damaged him. He was in some of the worst battles of the war, and he alludes to it very briefly in his interactions with Jeff, you know, about what happened to him, what things he saw in the Ardennes forest and the Herchin forest. And he also was involved with liberating the concentration camps, or at least acting as an intelligence. He wasn't an officer. He was a sergeant. But he was in an intelligence role in the war, and he debriefed a lot of German soldiers and a lot of concentration camp people. And when the war was over, after a couple of months, he actually had a nervous breakdown and was sent to a mental hospital back in either France or Belgium. I don't remember exactly. And he was in there for a number of weeks. When he came out, he started a romance with a German woman who was an ex-Nazi. In fact, she was a physician, a young physician. He married her. And then when they went back to America, he had the marriage annulled almost instantly. You know, after that, he embarked on his peculiar career romancing adolescent girls.
You don't seem like you're done with Jeff Greenaway yet.
Well, I do have these six novellas, which I'm probably going to publish in a compilation of all of them. And they're all pretty funny. You know, this is a pretty funny book. This is after all, even though it takes place during the tragic week of the Kennedy assassination,
yeah,
it's basically a comedy. And so are the novellas. And I'll probably do that. I'm not sure that I'm going to be writing much more with him in it. I think my next project's going to be a 1960s college hippie novel. I haven't covered that territory. I'm eager to do it. I started one about 25 years ago, and I'll probably actually return to that larval manuscript, you know, it'll be interesting to see how my attitudes have changed about, you know, what I lived through in having gone off to college in 1966.
Where did you go?
I went to a SUNY college, Brockport State.
Oh, sure.
I was a very bad high school student. I went to a pretty good high school in New York, but I was a terrible student with terrible grades. And I couldn't get into college. I got rejected from all the colleges I applied to. And the last... the month before the semester started, I sent three letters out to three SUNY schools because I had for some reason, a Regents scholarship. It was the only test that I actually did well on. And two of the schools, Oswego and New Paltz, sent me applications, and Brockport State sent me a dorm contract.
There you go.
So I called them up and I said, what's this dorm contract about? And they said, oh, that's where you live when you come here and go to school. So I never actually applied to the school. I just went up there and registered, and I was a matriculated student.
Well, it'd be fascinating weird. To read about that time. Yeah, that's and also I think of interest, given where higher education is now.
Higher education is in a very bad way, and I think it's really a sinking ship. My guess is that, you know, when it reorganizes itself, as it will once again be something like a finishing school.
Yeah. The new book is Look, I'm Gone, a novel by James Howard Kunstler. James, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I look forward to having you back. Maybe we'll talk about the collection or a new work, but it's always great to have you here. Thank you very much for sharing
this
morning.
Pleasure is mine, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Again, the name of the novel is Look, I'm Gone. James Howard Kunstler is the author. He will be speaking about the book on Thursday, January 15th at 6 p.m. at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York. You can find out more information about that event by going to Northshire.com. Northshire.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.